This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 106 was recorded on May 26th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Dr. Pippa Malmgren returns as my guest this week. Pippa, it's great to have you back on All-Stars. I've been in Pippa withdrawal syndrome, and I'm dying to ask you the question that seems to be on everybody's mind, which is, what's the shape of the economic recovery? Is it V-shaped? Is it L-shaped? Is it U-shaped? Pick a letter. Maybe we'll use Greek symbols. What letter should we be looking for here?
So actually, it's a concept rather than a letter, because it's not linear. And I think this is the key thing. It's quantum, not linear. And what I mean by that is, you know, nobody in the economy is ever affected on average. And the economy doesn't recover on average either. And so what I see is a splitting. And one group of people who are massive beneficiaries of the fact that we've done really a decade's worth of moving towards digitization in a matter of months, if not weeks. And the massive efficiency gains from that are going to fall to a certain part of the economy, certain group of companies and individuals, and that's an unbelievable bonanza. And then there are also people and businesses at the other end of the spectrum that are not going to recover ever, and there are whole sectors that won't exist in the same way that they used to. So you can have basically an incredible investment opportunity and recovery and a disastrous loss all at the same time. And I'm always saying it's a little bit like what happened in the 1920s after World War I and the Spanish flu, you know, which was a lot more aggressive than what we've had this time. With the Spanish flu, you could be fine at 10 a.m. and dead by midnight. Like this was much faster and more aggressive. But afterwards, lots of people were like, I am so glad I survived. I am definitely living, you know, and they spent money and they built businesses. And so I don't think it's a letter and I don't think it's linear. And the other thing that's really important is the rules of this game are not the same as they were. And this is always the hardest part because we like to revert to what we know. But You know from the past, I've argued for a long time, and I argued in my book Signals, that the disinflationary period of history, when you could count on the fact that the prices of most things would be falling over time, that this was an exception to the rule. It's not normally how things work in history. Usually prices go up and down, not just down. And I just wonder whether we haven't set the stage for the end of that deflationary window that lasted, call it 50 years, and a return to a more inflationary environment. And if that's the case, what you want to be investing in is very different from what you maybe think you should be investing in.
Let's talk about the market implications, both of the fact that it's, as you say, it's quantum, it's not linear. So we're not talking about a particular V shape or W shape or L shape or U shape. It's a few different letters superimposed on top of each other because different segments of the economy are doing different things in reaction to different drivers. But what does this mean? I agree with you that this could be the catalyst that brings about that secular shift from deflation to inflation. Boy, Pippa, we haven't seen a secular shift to inflation since the mid-1960s. And when it happened, it turned everything on its head. So what does that mean in terms of markets? How do they react? Is there a letter or a whole alphabet there, or what happens?
First, let's understand again, what was it that pushed inflation down? And there are a lot of different factors. One of them was globalization. And so there were always ever cheaper workers somewhere in the world that were willing to make the thing for even less. And that was true, but now that isn't true anymore. And so there isn't a place that's like cheaper than China. It was for a while, places in Southeast Asia like Vietnam, but that isn't even true anymore. And now the US has emerged as the least expensive place to make things. And so, you know, it's a constantly run race. Somebody will come back at some stage, but for now, workers around the world are saying, you just can't pay me any less because it's so paltry what I get paid now, I can barely survive. Like, there's a human limit to how far the efficiency of cheaper labor can be. And in fact, it reminds me, you know, after World War II, the founder of one of the biggest British department stores called Marks and Spencer was touring one of his shops, his high street shops, and one of the staff members fainted. And he took an interest in what had happened and realized that this poor woman had fainted from hunger. And at that point decided that he would provide free lunch for every employee of Marks and Spencer. Now, did he do that because he was generous, gracious? No, not really. He did it because you cannot expect human beings to be able to function if they don't eat. And we've kind of reached that point in the world economy that you can't pay them less because they can't survive on less. And if that's the case, in fact, where policy is going is the other direction. People need to make more than the bare minimum. They should be paid a wage that allows them to have some kind of a decent life. And so as we move in that direction, it just means that labor becomes more expensive. Now, labor is an ever smaller component of most of the things in this world, but still, it's the trend that matters. So the first thing is we don't have that endless pool of free labor anymore, and probably rightly so, and we need to adjust to that. The other thing is, you know, when you're lengthen out the global supply chain and you say, well, I'll take food from anywhere I can get it or product from anywhere I can get it at the cheapest price, well, you can push prices down a long way this way, but this is gone because the supply chain's broken at both ends. It's the supply end and the demand end. And this means that we're going to have more locally sourced food, more locally sourced production, and more likely that's going to be a little more expensive, not less. And if you've got a world where there are fewer tech companies in play, fewer entrepreneurs to date, I expect a new wave of them, but you know, less for now, again, that has a tendency to push prices up. Add higher taxes, which at some point is likely. Add more regulation, which is a possibility. These things are all inflationary in nature. And so that's why I think that all of the preconditions for that wonderful disinflationary period have now been taken away.
Pippa, you've described the supply chains breaking at both ends, but regardless of what might be causing those supply chains to break, and I agree with you, the fact remains that the U.S. has become very, very dependent on China. When this COVID-19 crisis broke out, one of the first things that we realized is, holy crap, we get all of our antibiotic drugs are made in China. And the few that are not made in China that are made in India, the people that make them in India are using Chinese raw materials supplies in order to make them. And without that supply from China, they can't make them either. Meanwhile, we don't have enough N95 masks in the United States because the U.S. government didn't do a very good job of planning ahead. And where do they come from? Well, they're made in China, except the factories in China are in the middle of their own lockdown because there's a pandemic crisis. So whether you think it's good or bad, the fact remains that our economy for the last several decades has become very, very dependent on China. Meanwhile, it seems to me like a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the White House lately suggests that once the immediate crisis is over, there's going to be a bumpy road ahead for U.S.-China relations. So what does all of this mean? Are we headed toward a situation where the U.S. perhaps is forced to eliminate its dependency on export from China because of political reasons? Or how do you see this playing out?
Well, I think when you say eliminate that dependency on imports, rather, is the way to think about it, what that means is build domestic capacity. And why haven't we built it before? Well, I think there are lots of contributing factors. You know, one of them, which is worth thinking about, is that the whole VC private equity community in America has for nearly 20 years taken the view that they would only invest in software. I think ever since Bill Gates gave that speech where he said software eats everything. And, you know, it's that crowd took the view and believed that you could just outsource anything physical, anything real. And the fact is, that's not true anymore. And what's really exciting, I think, about what happened with this COVID crisis, it was fascinating watching here in Britain, where I live, the guys at McLaren Formula One convert from being Formula One car makers to being makers of ventilators for hospitals. They just shifted what they were doing and retooled, and they did it in days. So, you know, when you say, how can we possibly restore our ability to make things? I say, watch that. And remember, too, in World War II, when we suddenly needed a whole lot of, you know, military aircraft, what happened? We assigned everybody who was available, which at that time was a lot of women, people who had not been sent off to the war effort. And did they build great aircraft? Yes, they did. In fact, I'm writing a bit about drones, you know, because I'm in the business of making drones and autonomous vehicles. And it's so fascinating to see, you know, where Marilyn Monroe was discovered? She was discovered working on the assembly line for the first mass production drone. So, you know, Marilyn Monroe, we're Rosie the Riveter. So I have no doubt we can create a new generation of Rosie the Riveters, except this time it will be a lot of people, not just women who weren't off in the war. It's just a question of what you decide is worthwhile making an investment in. And in a world where the supply chain is broken, we have to rethink, what is it that people really need, first of all? And could we make it here competitively, wherever here may be? And I think the answer is going to be yes. And that's exciting. And that's investable. This is a world where there are going to be a lot of new companies created, a lot of new kinds of innovation coming to the market. It's a step change, though. It's a bit like, you know, when the dot-com bubble burst. So the companies that you knew about that didn't make it in the dot-com bubble bursting, you felt like, oh, well, the tech boom is over. But if you look back in history, the tech boom was just starting. It's just that those particular companies didn't make it, but the concept of innovation and technology was just starting to accelerate. I think this is a similar kind of step change environment. So I'm not worried. We'll be able to create, the world will be able to create what it needs. In fact, I would say we're more than capable of creating what is needed. And people should be encouraged by that.
And what is your outlook for U.S.-China geopolitical relations?
I think it's really interesting that now the Democrat position is that the president is not being hard enough on the Chinese. And you'll hear Joe Biden say that more and more frequently going forward. And so there's a race to sort of beat the Chinese up. And that's not an easy environment. But the Chinese view is, well, this happens every time there's a presidential election, and so it will pass. This is an open question. Will it pass? And how will these two countries navigate their way on the global stage? Is this going to be a comfortable or uncomfortable after the next election? And I would say that it's going to continue to be uncomfortable. Because what we haven't done is to truly recognize what the mutual interests are and to reconcile them. So, for example, we cannot say to the Chinese public, I'm terribly sorry, but you guys are no longer competitive and we're able to build our own supply chain, so we don't need to buy the stuff from you anymore and good luck. No, we got a billion people who aspire to a better future, who need to be fed, who need to be clothed, and who have ambitions in this life. And so the world has to find a way to accommodate them and, frankly, to benefit from the extraordinary entrepreneurial energy and, you know, human capital that that represents. And at the same time, the Chinese can't go into the world saying it's our way or the highway, although, you know, America does that quite a lot, too. But it's a kind of different situation where the Chinese approach has lots of implications for governance in the society, for, you know, what is the nature of the social contract? And I think that's going to be a big argument across the world for some years to come. And again, it's against the backdrop of a lot of damage. And you know, I've argued that the damage done from this COVID shutdown is going to be worse than we think. Now, that doesn't mean we won't recover, but it does mean that we got to think about the political implications of all those who've been hurt by this thing. That'll be true in China, too. So everywhere politicians have a population that has to feel like there's hope and a better future for them. The ones that will generate a better future and make sure that everything is okay, they don't need the politicians so much. It's always the ones who aren't in a position to protect their own interests that fall back on politics. So I guess I'll finish by saying this. I do watch very carefully every day in the news for any sign of the US and China escalating their tension. And I don't mean only in terms of rhetoric. I also mean in terms of, you know, physical control over spaces and sparring for physical influence in certain locations in different parts of the world. Because this is a world where things are fragile and a little confrontation could turn into a big problem quickly. I don't think anybody wants it, but I'd say we're a little vulnerable to the oops factor where something just goes awry that you didn't plan.
Pippa, you've had a terrific track record at anticipating and predicting trends before they happen. I'd like to get your feedback. One of my predictions has been, you know, this COVID-19 crisis has forced both employers and employees very suddenly to learn how to cope with the maximum possible number of people working remotely, working from home. I predict that that will likely continue as businesses realize the opportunity to reduce their overhead cost of office space and so forth by continuing that practice. First of all, what do you think of that prediction? But more importantly, what else do you see in terms of changes and trends that might arise as a result of this crisis that people aren't seeing yet?
Look, I think one thing COVID has done, which is really good, is changed everybody's understanding of remote working and that it can be done. And we're seeing, like, law firms are saying, well, why do we have this big office building in the center of a major city with independent offices exclusively reserved for a single person? That's not really necessary anymore. But having said that, you know, it's great for people who have family responsibilities because it could be much easier to hire people who are working part-time from home, much easier to consider them to be an integral part of the workforce. Then again, not everybody lives in a great big house. And for some people, being at home with the kids is totally not an environment you get anything done in. So we're going to change the way we think and the way we I'm looking forward to seeing how office space gets reconfigured to deal with this new situation. I'm expecting that planning permission is going to be granted for buildings now that have offices on one floor and residential on another and urban farms on another and entertainment levels on another, that this multi-purpose approach to life is now going to be much more prevalent than it has been. So that's one thing. But, you know, humans still need to interact, and you cannot replace a live conversation with Zoom, even though, you know, Zoom is amazing. I don't know if you saw the other day, but, you know, the valuation of Zoom is greater than all 7 of the world's largest airlines combined. Now, I don't think that's going to last either, because you do need to actually see someone in the eye to know what are we doing. And that's going to be interesting, too. How we do that in future? How do we establish trust, basically? It's all about trust. So I think it's super exciting. And COVID is, like I said, it has advanced the world in terms of digitization by a decade. And all the efficiency gains that brings are incredible. It also means that people who've been knocked off the world economy by this event are going to have a hard time getting back. And we're going to have to think about how to extend a helping hand to them.
Pippa, before we let you go, we've had a few listeners ask, what is this drone lady all about? What does she mean she works on drones? Tell us, for people who are not familiar with your work at H Robotics, people know you as a presidential advisor, geopolitical consultant. How did you get from working in the White House advising President G.W. Bush on foreign policy to building drones?
You know, it's funny, I get this all the time, but really, it's all just a different way of expressing the same thing. I'm interested in the world economy. And so I worked in financial markets so I could understand how money moved in the international economy. I worked in trade policy so I understood how things moved. And then I realized that actually there was this revolution coming that involves digitizing reality. And that's what my drones really do. It's if you want to see your mining site in Africa or your agribusiness in Brazil, or you want to deal with an accident scene on a highway somewhere in America, you need to have an autonomous vehicle that either flies over it or rolls up to it or floats up on a boat and gives you not just the live view, but allows you to capture in minute detail exactly that situation and preserve it. And I think that this is the way that huge value is going to be created in the world economy, because you won't have to guess anymore. You will know the situation on the other side of the world in real time. And this will allow you to bring all kinds of machine learning and artificial intelligence to situations that haven't had the benefit of that before. So I just, I'm just expressing a kind of view on a trend in the world economy. And it struck me back in about 2012 that this was a huge trend. The wave was coming of digitization and autonomy. And so that's the space I'm in.
Tell us a little bit more about the state of that space, because I know you're a very forward thinker, but at the same time, what little I know of that industry, you know, everybody knows there's these really cool drones. Some of them are toys that you just, you know, buy to take pictures with. You can, you know, fly it over your house and get an aerial view of your house and so forth. You don't work with the toys, you work with the commercial side. But as I understand that, you know, it still is something that an operator has to fly sort of like a remotely piloted aircraft. It seems to me like if I owned several, let's say I'm a rancher and I own several ranches and I'm worried about whether people are, you know, stealing my cattle or something, what I'd love to do is have just pre-programmed flight plans where every morning the drones take off and they fly a certain route and they take today's video of what's going on at all of the key locations on my properties, and they automatically send me back the results and I don't have to learn how to fly anything. Is the industry at the state of being able to do that yet? And if not, where is it? And what's the next hurdle that needs to be crossed?
Yeah, so that is exactly what my company does. And that's what we do in different parts of the world. The regulators are catching up because their approach was to deal with the kid with a toy. And so they have big controls on how drones can be used and where. But the FAA in the United States, the Federal Aviation Authority, has definitely come out and said that they see the commercial applications growing at an incredible speed. And the efficiency gains for the economy are so huge that they want to encourage that. So basically, they're going to control the retail consumer use much more heavily, in my opinion. And the commercial use, they're going to lighten up on and allow people to do things like what you say. But it's got to be under the control of a corporation on a controlled piece of property, you know, a lot of certainty about how something's being used, that it can't be stolen and be used for bad purposes and stuff like that. But it's fascinating because most people say, well, there are loads of drones. And I say, yeah, but what's really interesting is that most of them can't be used by industry. They're not rugged enough. They don't have enough deep data. And amazingly, they're single purpose and they don't talk to each other. So you can't assemble a fleet. And it's just struck me that the only thing that's useful for a big global corporation is a fleet. Well, this is still a brand new idea. It's a bit like in the world of medical devices, you know, like MRI scanning machines, huge, expensive pieces of equipment. You would think that the scan of a human being who probably is in some, you know, danger and needs urgent attention, you would think that that would be emailed, or, you know, the detail of that scan could be Wi-Fi'd somehow quickly. But no, are any of those machines internet enabled? Typically, no. And why? Because people just were thinking, I'm making this one device for this one location, for this one purpose. And so it's amazing. In many, many fields, you find that things are not as connected yet as they're going to be. And I think that's the thing about what I'm doing is just, I'm creating a platform for that connectivity. And that's, you know, innovative thinking in this space has typically been focused on the retail consumer interests, like, will they go faster? And can you race them? And, you know, how cool do they look? But for industry, what really matters is, can I make a decision faster, better? Can I see an environmental problem develop before my eye could see it, that the cameras or the lenses or the sensors can see something that I could never see if I were standing there myself? And the answer is absolutely. So I think it's such an exciting space, I have to say.
Well, Pippa, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.